Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for the podcast version of Trey's Variety Hour is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Well, welcome everybody to the Hangout. This is going to be an amazing one. I'm super excited about everybody here and about the topic. The topic tonight is wearable cameras of the distant future, sort of sci-fi of pretty much right now. And we have many great guests here, but we kind of do have a guest of honor, and he kind of inspired this and inspired me and has kind of influenced this topic. And it is Daniel Suarez, the famous sci-fi author. He's joined us, and he has written several books. The first book that caught my attention was Daemon, and the sequel was Freedom TM, and talked about a lot about these wearable cameras and augmented reality and this sort of thing. And Daniel has a new book coming out this summer, which you can pre-order now, and I'll pass the torch to him. He can say hello and maybe tell you something new about his new book.
Hey, guys. It's good to be here. Trey, thanks. My new book is Kill Decision. And it is a tech thriller as well, but it's a tech thriller about autonomous drone proliferation. So I always like to do fiction that's just over the horizon. Thus the wearable cameras and Daemon and Freedom TM. And autonomous drones is one of those things that I see as really just over the horizon, particularly the proliferation of autonomous drones.
I think it's already passed. Hey, it's already over.
Yeah, well, it's definitely going to expand. Hey, Kevin, how are you, man?
Nice to see you.
Hey, Kevin, how's it going?
Hi, Trey.
Good. Okay, next I want to introduce Leo, who's doing something probably with a camera and social networking here.
I'm not wearing it, but I have a. I could wear it. It's a Galaxy Note. Wearing this on my forehead would be a little bit much, I think.
Surgical implant.
You know, there was a. Hey, Leo here. How you doing?
Good. You know, you're the one that first introduced me to Daemon. So it's thanks to you that I actually got the book and got into it. So thank you.
What a great book. I mean, it was the book of the year. Was it 2010, Daniel? I think it was 2010.
It came out in 2008.
Eight?
So it's been kicking around for a while. I wrote it in 2004, so it took a while to percolate.
And was that finding a publisher that took so long?
Yeah. And ultimately, I didn't find one. I self-published it in 2006, and then it started worming its way through Google and Microsoft and places like that. And then all sorts of agents came to me. And then,
so you have something in common with our host, Trey, and with a guy named Jonathan Colton. Mm-hmm. You were a computer guy first.
Yeah. Yes.
And then you got it's as was Trey and as was Jonathan Colton, and you got the bug to be an artist.
Yeah, I wonder. I think I probably got the bug to be a computer guy, partly as a means to express artistic. Because I really view writing complex code as an art as well.
I agree.
Because there's a sort of a knack to it that some people don't have, I find. But, it was. I look also at knowledge of technology as sort of the modern literacy. Like, you have to have a firm base in technology to be able to express yourself adequately nowadays.
That's truthfully why I do what I do. I feel like that's what TWIT is about. That's what Tech TV was about before it, my radio show before that was about. I felt like, and I think we agree on this, that technology is the lever, you know, to move the world.
Yes.
But you have to know how to use the lever.
That's right.
And so that was job one, was to like get, not to be elitist, but to make sure everybody got access to this.
Well, yeah. It is a force multiplier.
Right.
Essentially. Code especially.
Right.
Huge. Well, you can tell that you know a lot about this from the writing because, well, you don't over-explain it. You don't under-explain it. It's not Hollywoodized. It's just right. Perfect.
Yeah, it's great to hear.
Yeah, let me also introduce our other guest here. We have Kevin Kelly, one of the founders of Wired, and just wrote a book called What Technology Wants. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Trey. Hi, Dan. Hi, Leo.
Hi, Kevin.
Some of these other faces I don't recognize.
I want to get the book that you sent me because Kevin is also a great photographer in his own right. I have it over here. It's a signed copy. I'm so excited. But I want to introduce Gordon Lang. So, Leo, Gordon is kind of my secret sauce. You know, you invite me on your show from time to time to talk about like the D800. I go on Tech News Today.
Yeah.
Gordon is always the guy that I contact first to make sure that I understand all the impregnable interstices of these cameras because, you know, you read the tech specs, but beyond the tech specs, it's sort of a black box. You don't really know. Well, Gordon runs CameraLabs.com. He knows everything inside the black box. So go ahead and say hi, Gordon.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me, Trey. As Trey said, I run a site called CameraLabs.com. My job is to test digital cameras and to brief Trey, obviously, behind the scenes, try and make him look good. He does such a great job anyway. I mean, how can anyone make him look better? I've also started publishing some ebooks since he's... Oh, he sat back down again. I'm going to get my plug in anyway, just quick. Just published a brand new one today on landscape photography. It's by two great landscape photographers based in Queenstown, New Zealand. And it takes you through 30 really nice pictures. So if you're interested in landscape photos or if you use a digital cameras, check out CameraLabs.com.
So here's Kevin Kelly's book. He is...
on paper.
What's that?
Yeah.
It's called Aging Grace. It's wonderful. He's an incredible photographer. I'm happy to know him. And, you know... There's a personal inscription in here. I won't read it because it's personal. But, you know, when there's someone you admire and they send you something personal with a inscription, it just kind of made my heart double rate for a while. It was so thank you for that, Kevin. I appreciate
that's
it.
That's the
much.
Power of paper. It's amazing what it can do these days.
Yeah.
It's funny. Paper has more value now, doesn't it?
Yeah. No, I'm going to tilt my camera over to my two-story library here.
Wow.
So
and,
nice.
I was almost going to give up my library. A couple of years ago, I thought, I'm going to get rid of it, go digital. But I've changed my mind because I realized that paper libraries are going to be such a rarity in about 50 years from now. And if there's really nothing like this, you know, battery-less, random access book, that is going to have a power in 50 years. This is actually the time to make a library because you can buy books for $1 on Amazon. Right. And you could make this a fantastic collection. Brewster Kahle is buying remnants from Amazon by the truckload.
And really? Can,
yes. And he's scanning them and then saving them. But he has a warehouse where he's stockpiling 1 million books in Richmond, a warehouse in Richmond, California, on pallets and containers inside this warehouse. Buying them for almost nothing, and they're going to be so powerful in 50 years from now. You just walk down these rows, and you have all these books. They never go out of date. They'll always be readable. They're sitting there without any extra power. They're random access. They're really incredible. So, anyway, I'm like Gordon, really trying to make as many ebooks as possible, and I'm sure Daniel's, you know, probably has more readers soon electronically than on paper. But I think there's something about paper that's really, really powerful.
You know? I feel really lame sending you a PDF earlier to sign it or anything.
No, but I'm cool.
I feel terrible now.
No,
isn't the value of it, though, that it's arcane, that it's archaic?
No, here's what it is. It turns out we did a study at the Getty Museum trying to figure out how to store digital stuff over long term. Digital is really great for replicating in time,
right,
across everywhere, but it's really horrible about replicating over time, like over 100 years. And it's what I call, what you need is not storage, you need movage, because you're constantly having to migrate it to the next thing, and it's constantly moving. Right. It's the only way it survives. And that movage is actually hard to imagine. How the only things that get moved are things that are loved, they get attention. And so this issue of actually how you keep digital stuff going over time is actually not easy to figure out. And I think that has some impact in what we're talking about, you know, wearable cameras. Okay, where's all these images going? Where are they going to be stored? You know, and once you have these pictures, how do you move them into the future? How do you move them so that they stay relevant? And I think just capturing them is sort of an issue. That's a big thing. But making sure that they continue in time, That's a more complex problem.
These are all wonderful thoughts. That's why I love Kevin, because I feel like sometimes a good question is better than a good answer. And
yeah, I'm good at questions. I'm not very good at answers. That's a journalist's job, is to ask questions.
Yeah. Well, I want to get started with Daniel here and ask him something. But first, let me explain something so we don't lose half the audience. What are we even talking about here? Because we may take it for granted because we kind of stew ourselves in AR and we don't really – we might take it for granted. So largely, we're talking about the sphere of AR or augmented reality. And this is a possible future, or in fact, a probable future that humans will move into, at least those that want to be connected, like those of us on the internet. And the first iteration of this will probably be some sort of eyeglasses type system that have an extra layer on top of the reality you're seeing, the augmented reality, where you can see, for example, you look at something and it's an internet connected set of glasses. So you might see an old friend, you don't remember their name, it might show their name. You look at a flower, you don't know what it is. It says what kind of flower it is and tells you about it. Maybe there's something in the distance that you can't quite make out. Well, maybe your right lens zooms in on it, and so you can identify it, or maybe the internet helps you identify it. You can share your stream that you're seeing with other people. So the whole area of AR is very interesting, but you know, we can take it any direction. These hangouts are very, very freeform. I'm particularly interested in the camera side of it, you know, how it might work. What's the difference between just streaming just raw data versus people like me that might want to use it to make art and share it in kind of a real-time way? All that's very interesting to me. And it was all spurred because of this book, Demon, by Daniel. And he just said in the little pre-show that he started writing this back in 04.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what's it been like? How has the world unfolded to you? Is it kind of going in the same direction that you anticipated it, or is it sort of on a
yes and no? Yes and no. And actually, Kevin actually does a great job in this and what technology wants, and that is when a technology's time has come, there's really no stopping it, and it is going to move forward. And we can adjust the direction it takes somewhat. And I do think augmented reality, wearable cameras are like that. The form factor has shrunk down to such a small degree, ubiquitous connectivity with wireless cameras and headsets. It's an obvious thing now. Sort of like at some point when the gasoline-powered engine came into being, it suddenly became easier. And then in rapid order, we were flying because we finally had an engine that could give us the power to do that. So I think augmented reality is just like that. I would also think that we're really in the second generation of it already, because I know a lot of people use smartphones and they'll use things like AR and products like that to look at various augmented reality layers. And I think it more and more is going to be built into the form of an object, let's say heads-up glasses like the coming Google glasses or Apple heads-up displays that people are working on. And it's going to be seamless. And that's part of my concern, is that walking around with advertising popping up would be irritating. So that goes into the decisions we'd have to make about what we're willing to tolerate, whether it's going to be very intrusive, how we make the balance between utility and also feeding something back to the people who will pay to create it. And I think we see that already now with social media. People giving up a great deal, and maybe they'll think about that later, what they're giving up in terms of privacy, to be connected. And we'll see that in a much more graphical way in augmented reality. Because I think the thing that is interesting to me about augmented reality is it lets you see the data that might be affecting your life. And when I was writing Demon, that was the interesting thing to me, the idea of seeing the data in the same way you see your environment in three-dimensional reality. I might see a car coming towards me and know to get out of the way. And if I see some sort of data event coming towards me in three-dimensional reality, I can know to defend myself. And that was an intriguing notion to me, because certainly data does rule our modern lives. So being able to project that in geospatial, in a geospatial environment seemed really important to me. And I think we're almost there.
One of the cool tropes for people who haven't read the book is that as people walk around and you're in this data sphere, you see a game style bubble above their heads that show their, you know, their hit points, their experience points, their level,
their reputation.
Their reputation. And I think that's so cool. And that's a really good example of augmented reality being more than just, here's the Wikipedia entry for this, or here's this guy's two kids. It actually enables something like a reputation system, which couldn't exist without that.
Right. Very clear that I think having that data, having numbers and that quantification also lends itself to the gamification of all kinds of things that right now would be very difficult to do. But when you're walking around and you have numbers, the first impulse people have when they have numbers is to make them higher.
Right.
Right. So, okay. So we got these numbers. How high can I make it? And that suddenly you're in a game and you're being awarded points and you're carrying around your levels or whatever it is. And I think, that, again, some of what Dan's book goes is a little bit kind of exploring that. But there's also other science fiction writers, the last book from Bill Gibson, he calls it the locatives, this whole idea of this art. He was talking about art being made, and you kind of had to have a password or be invited a space that would look normal to everybody else. But if you were part of the in-group, you would see an entirely different thing augmented on top of this space. It would be something else. And so there was this idea of the secret view of the world. That was the art, was that you could take what would look normal to everybody else, and there would be this overlay on it that would be accessible to those who were in the know, or they were cool enough or whatever.
It's a private dimension.
Yes, right. There you go. Yeah.
It would bring back the Freemasons.
It would make for an interesting ritual.
I think one of the interesting things about this is that a lot of these cameras that we're talking about are kind of live surveillance type systems and not, say, the art of taking still photos with a traditional camera like we have today. And when I was thinking about this, when Trey was talking about, you know, should we do this hangout about distant cameras of the future, you think about the books you've read and the films you've seen. And I was a bit alarmed to kind of realize that I don't think I've ever seen anyone take a still photo in any book or film that I've seen. There's an awful lot of surveillance, a lot of augmented reality, heads-up displays, that sort of thing. But very few people actually pursuing photography or still photo capture or even video capture as a leisure activity. So I kind of see it diverging in two ways. There's the devices that will wear, like the glasses or even like a GoPro today or something, you know, a wearable camera that will augment our reality live and give us feedback. But then there's the other devices. There's the hobby of photography, of actually taking photos, and where that's going to go. That's why I think it's quite interesting that they're diverging like that.
But, you know, I know, Trey, you're interested in the camera aspect of this, but just as the artist, there was a moment in the 50s and 60s when there were artists who did not draw or paint. And actually, I think they're going to be photographers who don't use a camera. If you've seen some of the work at the Media Lab with the guys going like this.
Right, yeah.
To frame something. And so if you have ubiquitous cameras everywhere, why do you even need to carry a camera? Mm. Your art, your photography may be in actually selecting the view. In fact, the guy who was doing the Google Earth photography, where they were finding things on Google Earth and framing them, it was a little bit like that. So it's very possible. It's not too far to imagine that you could have the photographer of the future who doesn't know how to use a camera, just as we had artists of today who can't paint.
Well, I think that the artists of today were already pretty good at composing and separating what is interesting from what is uninteresting. And in this world that we're going into, everyone will be streaming all the time. You won't just be putting your status update on Facebook, right? You'll just be able to tune into your friends' streams whenever they happen to be broadcasting. And as we know, most of the day is quite dull, right? Even if you're in an interesting place, most of that day is quite dull. But maybe it's the artists among us that will be able to kind of curate our day. And like, these are the 5 most beautiful minutes of my day, which you either edit into a little slideshow or a sequence of 5-second clips, interesting things that you've done. Maybe you put good filters on them. Mm-hmm. But you do kind of create your own little highlight reel of the day, and that's kind of available for people that follow you or are interested in your art.
You know, you're a talented artist, though, Trey, and for artists that makes sense. for most people, the pictures we take are of so little interest or value to anybody, maybe not even in our family. You know, we have, I noticed this myself, huge volumes of photos. Well, look at your Facebook timeline. Who looks at that besides you or a stalker? So to some extent, maybe it needs curation, but I'm thinking that it also creates a whole bunch of content that only appeals to you.
Well, no, I think you're wrong. I think there's something happening now with things like Instagram and Facebook where you take a photo.
People who are artists are good.
Well, but anyone artist, can get on Instagram, and it kind of makes, no matter whether you have 10 followers or 20 followers or 50 or friends or whatever, when you put stuff up, you do get a little bit of a charge out of it. So there's a soft social pressure for people to curate interesting things and put it up, even if they would never call themselves or an artist.
That's a good point. So when I post, you're absolutely right. When I post publicly, I think about the shot, and I'm always looking for shots to put on Path or Instagram because there's soft social pressure. I think that's a good way to put it. What about, here's an interesting idea. If you do have reputation bubbles or informational bubbles, what about the use of it as a that's good. That's scary. That's terrible.
There it is. I just took a picture without a camera.
Somebody curate, please.
What about the use of reputation for societal control? Couldn't people, because Kevin Kelly brought up this really interesting idea of gamification. You're right. We're like rats. We have to keep pressing the pellet button. Once this gamification starts, we got to keep increasing our follower counts or our reputation score or whatever it is. And we almost can't not do it. Wouldn't this be a useful tool for manipulators? I mean, you know, I assume Foursquare is mostly benign, but if somebody really weren't benign, couldn't they use this to manipulate people into maybe appropriate social behavior? Is this the reinvention of religion?
Yes.
It's your idea.
You uncovered him. Yeah, you know what I think about this. Definitely, I would think you'd need as many hands as possible making it open source to prevent that, distribute the power, because certainly a gatekeeper could really misuse this. Yes. I think there's no doubt about that.
Right. My philosophy is that if technology is not powerful unless it can be powerfully abused. All right? It's not powerful unless it can be powerfully abused. And so we are making one of the most powerful technologies ever, and it will be powerfully abused. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's going to be. So we have to kind of, you know, keep that in mind. But you can't – that's not any reason not to make these powerful technologies.
No, but it is a reason to consider the ways it might be abused so that you can be
growing. Right.
Yeah, very interesting. So let me ask something about the brain, and maybe, I don't know who wants to chime in on this, maybe Kevin or Daniel, but, you know, maybe you've seen these glasses. They're not AR glasses. They're prism glasses, and what they do is they translate reality 45 degrees off in one direction, and they've done experiments where they put like cutlery or steak in front of people, and they have to cut the steak, and everything is 45 degrees off.
Oh, man.
And of course, they're all over the place, but in about 5 minutes, their brain catches on, right? And everything is distorted, but they do it perfectly. And then, you know, I was thinking, I used to be a big Quake player, and to be an effective Quake player, you would change the default FOV, the field of vision, from 90 degrees to like 130 degrees, so you could see even more. Well, and after a while, your brain actually got used to seeing 130 degrees. So if you have these AR glasses, right, and you're taking a picture basically in front of you, could you train your brain to see 150 degrees, 180 degrees, or even 360 degrees? Can you have your brain process that much information?
So in other words, you're augmenting your field of vision through these glasses, and then you're processing more information.
Right.
Is that what
you're
saying?
You train your brain to see that much at one time?
You can. And there's a couple of little examples of people who have done this in an augmented way. There's a great hack that they did down at Noise Bridge here in San Francisco. And the guy took a digital compass, and he made a belt, put it on a belt. And he put little piezoelectric buzzers on his belt around in a compass. And what the belt would do, it would indicate where north was. So after wearing this for a week, he had an intuitive sense of exactly where north was all the time. He didn't have to think about it, because this belt is basically always giving him a little subconscious buzz where north was, which he didn't even feel after a while. So he suddenly, you know, was taking on this new sense that, you know, say bees or a bird might have of directional, intuitive, exact cardinal direction. And it was just like his brain just kind of just absorbed, just sucked in this new sensor and made it part of him. And he was just, you know, he said he could just, you ask him where north was, he would say, you know, right there, exactly where it was.
Wow. But we see that all the time, of course. We see upside down, for instance, but we don't know it.
Right.
The brain's amazing at that kind of thing.
Yeah. So I think it's a really great vision tree. I think it's, you're exactly right that one of the things you'll see is that people seeing infrared, ultraviolet. You know, if you wear special glasses and you wear it long enough, you'll be able to see in that new sense and to acquire augmented senses.
Oh, I love that.
And so it's not just augmented reality, it's probably augmented senses. This is sort of, I think, the extended self. That's what we're doing, is we're just extending our self into all these other dimensions and senses. And those glasses or the other things that we're wearing will be part of that.
Kevin, talk a little bit about your thoughts on screening and streams and this sort of direction that we're already going independently of AR and how that will probably collide with it.
So there's the whole life streamers, life loggers. There's Gordon Bell, you know, at Microsoft, who wears the little the camera on his chest. It takes a picture every 5 minutes, and it's stored on his servers, and he has access to it, and also his recording. So there's a sense in which we record everything. So besides the environment recording things, we ourselves have the capability. The glasses that we see and augment can also be recording what they're seeing. And that idea of making your live stream, so you have a complete record of everything you see, every conversation, every keyboard, and you kind of craft a stream through your life, and everything's arranged chronological. This is David Gelertner's idea of the life stream. And that actually becomes the organizing principle for all this stuff. It's not going to be file folders like the desktop. It's actually going to be streams. It's your Google Plus, your Twitter, your Pinterest. It's that stream of stuff that just goes on and on and on, including a recording of everything that you are seeing and that you are doing. And you're recording it because it's free, because it costs nothing, because there are advantages of all types. And I think that becomes kind of the organizing metaphor for the future. So you have a photo stream, you have a click stream, you have a memory stream, you have a conversation stream. I mean, everybody wants to be able to scroll back in a conversation, right? I mean, scrolling, that whole, I want to be able to scroll back in life, right? I mean, everybody wants to scroll back.
Yeah. Some moments more than others, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's the metaphor that we're starting to lean towards in terms of the metaphor for understanding this arrangement of stuff. And so I'm going to have my stream, you'll have your stream, and where our streams intersect, that's an encounter, that's a transaction, that's a meeting, that's whatever it is. And so right now we have, you know, eight streams. We have eight light streams are now intersecting right now. And when we're done, our live streams will continue on and maybe we'll intersect again.
Now, Kevin, do you anticipate that software would help you curate that stream and help comprehend what's in it?
Yeah.
I think of things like visual intelligence software that don't just try to identify objects, but try to understand what's going on in a scene and predict what might happen. Right. And I see those types of systems really having tremendous influence in, again, helping people who have access to that information. Let's say looking at the streams of a million people, trying to find coincidences. Sorry, my phone is vibrating here. Trying to find intersections and meaningful events before they're commonly known. And right. I think
it strikes me that we're constantly fed more information than we can deal with anyway. That software might be the most important thing, more important than adding any more detail to the life we already lead. What we really need is a way to manage all the information we already have access to.
I think that's the we're already at that point with like DNA sequencing. Right now, we've reached a kind of a crossover point where the cost of sequencing your genes has now been exceeded by the cost of analyzing the data by the genes. In other words, it's cheaper to sequence your genes than it is to deal with the data that you generate by it.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that's where we're going to be headed towards, where it's like it's going to be cheaper to take a picture than it is to process a picture, which talk about trade, not that, right? Right. I mean, in terms of time, we're already there.
That's what the internet did. The internet opened a fire hose straight into our mouths, and now our big challenge is, what the hell do we do with all this stuff?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We're already there.
Well, I think that we're finally at the point where we can rejigger our own personal Dunbar 150, right? Because for kind of accidentally filled up our village with whoever Hollywood has been jamming into our living rooms, right? They've, you know, Angelina Jolie and Gilbert Gottfried and all these people have accidentally become part of our village. They don't need to be there, right? I'm replacing them with Kevin Kelly and Daniel Suarez and people that the internet are helping me to curate.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just wait till I start dancing.
Dancing
well, filter.
No, it's great. I can't wait.
So, Leo, you're the most hardcore of all of us in terms of streaming your life. Do you think, can you ever foresee a point when you're like, oh, it's too much? I got to dial it back a little bit.
Well, it's a lot easier. No, actually, it's really easy to put it out there. It's consuming it. As I said, the fire hose is easier to spew than it is to drink. And I really think that all of the most interesting stuff is going to happen in managing information. You know, I mean, a good example is Twitter, which is both a tool for creating new content and in some degree a tool for managing that content. Very rudimentary, but getting there. What Twitter ended up being, besides the fact that it became a fire hose of its own, was a way for people to curate, to kind of auto-curate stuff for me. And I think that I think that's an unintended consequence of Twitter. But I think that's where things are really going to get interesting is how do, and I think it's humans that need to do it. I think algorithms are not very good at curating, but that's why, I think that's why we're so interested in social. It's not so much we want more pictures of our friends, as we want our friends to help us manage this influx of information.
Right. So speaking of kind of streams and cameras, yesterday, Stephen Levy, the Wired author, challenged me with a bet, made a wager. And his wager was that in 10 years, more than 50% of video would be live video. Mm. More than 50% of the video on the internet would be live. Mm. And I was just wondering, I took the other side of that bet.
You bet against that?
Yeah.
You're crazy.
tell me why that's going to happen.
I made a bigger bet than either of you. I made a $1.2 million bet building this studio all around being live. All of our revenue, every bit of our revenue as a podcast comes from non-live downloads. Very small fraction of it comes from live. But I'm with Stephen because I think there's something about live that's so compelling. It's normal. It's human interaction. It's rough. It's real. It's authentic. And it's happening right now, and people know that. Something in your wiring in your brain knows the difference between watching the Grammys last night, 3 hours delayed on the West Coast, versus watching them live. It was a dumb thing the Grammys did, and the Oscars don't do that, by the way. They live, and they know the difference.
And that would suggest then to Trey's question that what we would see was photographers photographing live.
Yes. It's happening already.
That would, you would pay to watch them basically do it live.
That's how Scott Kelby makes a living. Right, Trey? Aren't there a lot of people doing this? There's live workshops everywhere.
Yeah, workshops. I mean, they're actually doing their art.
Well, that's what they are. That's what they are, really. People will watch them work live. Absolutely. And that's what Google Hangouts, I think the success of Google Hangouts is exactly that.
Well, if you have 100 million people having wearable cameras, and you have a lot of, 100 million points of streams of live video, that's where you really get into the power of, imagine using a Google search engine that searches reality as it's unfolding. Mm-hmm. Right. That you have visual intelligence software that somehow interprets all of these streams and then helps you categorize and find it.
Humans are voyeurs.
So,
Daniel, give me an example of what something might happen with that, with that kind of a...
Well, I was actually, one of the things that I was looking at in my next book, I won't try to plug it, was that idea that if you put visual intelligence and you plug drones into the streams of video coming through, you plug them into social media, and you give them autonomy, and of course you give them an insect-level intelligence. That's one use. I mean, certainly the proliferation of drones and swarms of drones, that's what I'm looking at in this book because, of course, it's a thriller. But you can look at it like a spectrum, everything right down to advertising. All of these streams feeding into trying to find your audience even before they know that they're your customer. You're able to use algorithms perhaps to identify them. If you have hundreds of millions of people with this live stream and you're able to interpret what they're looking at. So this is perhaps extreme, but I can imagine you might be doing something, climbing a rock, and suddenly you get this email saying, do you need a piton?
And then the 3D printer spits it out, right?
Yeah, you might need one. So,
in your pocket, yeah.
Yeah.
Or someone's selling you a video of the guy who got stuck under that rock in Utah.
Yeah, that's probably more likely.
Yeah. Would you like to stream it now?
No.
120.
Yeah, don't show me that.
You have a modal dialogue box and you're trying to get a pizza on it. It's just not
Hey,
good.
Daniel, do you think it's possible that we may not necessarily be streaming off of our AR glasses or whatever devices we have attached to our person? Do you think that we might have our own personal drones that go with us and are recording this information sort of from a third-person perspective?
Oh, like a familiar?
Yeah.
A floating familiar? I suppose, although I'd imagine there have to be some etiquette growing up around that in restaurants. No drones. No drones in this section. No drone section.
No droning.
Yeah, really.
Remember when Justin started Justin TV?
Yeah, yeah. So what happened? Why didn't that take over the world?
I think he got tired of it, but I mean, it was very compelling. And Jenny Cam going even back before that, it was very...
Wait, but, I mean, why didn't others take it up?
That's interesting. I don't know.
It's cumbersome.
Because it's, well, no, I think mostly, who was the guy who started Pseudo.com and did that? Josh, is it Harris who started
Josh
that?
Harris. Josh Harris.
Yeah. He did the exact same thing in 10 years ago, in 1991, something like that, or 92. Mm-hmm. He wired an apartment with cameras everywhere, and it took a huge personal toll on his psychology.
Yeah.
And eventually, he just had to quit. It takes an unusual person to be on camera all the time.
Well, there was even before that, there was, a man, right, the guys at MIT,
right.
Steve Mann walking around with his cyborg thing. And another guy who was doing it for a couple of years, broadcasting the whole thing live. It was wireless. I mean, it was everything that we're talking about 20 years ago.
This is where curation does become a little bit important. For instance, I'm thinking about this hangout, which is so great, and the conversation is so great. And Trey, thank you for this show.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm thinking, well, gosh, I should just do hangouts all the time. And then I realized, no, there's a problem, because this is where moderation and curation is an important thing, because we could just have a hangout going all the time, but it would get chaotic in the same way that real life gets chaotic. So this is, you started this conversation, Trey, and I think you hit something there with when you used the word art. That's what art really is. It's curation, isn't it? In a way.
Yeah, I think so. And you can't have like a steady stream of being maximally stimulated all day long, right? It's nice to have ups and downs, like a child, really. All children have ups and downs, and you have periods of excitement and periods of sadness. And the same thing happens as an adult. You do like, we are sort of these circadian creatures still, and we do like to schedule certain things. And if you could be part of a live event, even if you're not necessarily there, I think all the people watching now live feel like they're at a coffee shop with us, and they're sitting there just kind of watching the conversation, not really participating, curated. But they feel like they're there.
Yes, but it is carefully curated. You know, Ira Glass talks about this when he talks about This American Life. There are beats. This is what actors call it. In radio production, you might use the same phrase, of about 40 seconds where you have a beginning, middle, and an end. You know, you go up and down and up and down. And whether it's conscious or unconscious, a true artist creating television, radio, live streaming, photography, whatever, is conscious of this, what you talked about, these rhythms, and is in a way guiding the viewer through this. Unguided, uncurated video maybe isn't very good.
Well, you can see that on YouTube. You just go to any random YouTube thing, and it's awful. But well, the curated thing about, stuff is really good.
But the other thing about curation is that it's not just choosing the best bits or choosing the right people to present it, but also choosing the right mediums to consume it. It doesn't have to be video with sound at a certain frame rate and frame shape. It could be a still photo. It could be music. It could be, and like Trey was saying, there's ups and downs. For me, when I'm consuming media, it's important for me to not watch TV the whole time. Sometimes I want to do some stuff on the computer. Sometimes I just want to listen to music or read a book. So, you know, the curating process is also about the means by which the information is presented for me.
Right. Hey, Gordon, let me ask you about some of the tech here. Because I know you love going tech crazy. I don't know if we're really still sticking to Moore's Law or not when it comes to processors. They say it's gone. I don't really know. It kind of seems to be close enough for government work. But let's look at the iPhone 6 or the iPhone 7 or the iPhone 8. You can get so much into this tiny little camera now. Is there really any scientific limit as to what you can do with the tiny little lens?
Well, I think it's more look at it the other way in terms of where do you want it to go? You know, rather than letting the technology drive us, let us drive the technology. And one of the most interesting things that happens whenever, you see, photographers are very old-fashioned, traditional people. A lot of them are. And every time a new type of camera or form factor or development comes out, there is an increasing cry of, no, that's not what we want. I love my camera the way it is, you know, like optical viewfinders and so on and so forth. And that got me thinking that while I believe the whole kind of augmented reality tech can go really as far as you want it to go, it could be, you know, drones, it could be surgical, it could be, you know, it could go way, way, way forward. In terms of the actual taking still photos as the art, as I was saying earlier, maybe we're already actually quite close to as far as it's going to go. Look at a paintbrush or a pencil, you know what I mean? They don't really invent new paintbrushes anymore, but yet people are still painting. So maybe digital cameras are getting good enough for what people want to use them for that kind of art. Obviously, there's different ways you can capture images and manipulate them. You know, we're seeing the light field technologies and maybe recording scenes in a different way. I honestly don't think we're always going to divide everything up into a two-dimensional grid, you know, and capture it that way, which is the way most digital photos are taken now. That will probably change. But in terms of, you know, curating a scene, saying this is the way I think it should be presented, I want it to be a bit darker or a bit more saturated, then I think we're honestly quite close. And that's not such a bad thing, you know. Although maybe I'm talking myself out of a job, because my job's to review new cameras. And if we're encouraging, no, you know, it's okay, stop making them. We're happy with them now.
So, Trey, one of the things, I don't think the camera lenses has to keep getting smaller. They can actually get bigger without getting deeper. We can have flat lenses that are more like a multi lenses, like a dragonfly lens, where you have where it's flat and there's 1,000 little lenses that are flat, so they're not very thick, but they're big, and they're computationally derived, focusing at depth of field, things like that. So I think that we're not anywhere near the end of the evolution of even the optical side of things. And there are reasons besides just pixel count to have improvements in the actual photographic aspect of these cameras. As you were mentioning, Gordon's mentioning three-dimensional, I mean, ways to do 3D, ways to do the difference between moving images and a still image, sound, you know, all kinds of things are still to come just with the evolution of the camera itself. But I think the question of whether you want to carry a device that's a camera, I think that's a more interesting question. I've been asking people like at conferences and stuff, in 10 years, how many devices do you want to carry with you? Do you want to carry, and you know, it comes down to one or none.
Right.
Really, basically. I'm on the none side. I don't want to carry any devices at all.
What is the point of the camera? Which it's to record a visual perception. I think we shouldn't even be thinking about cameras. We should be thinking about nanotechnologies that can record not just the visual sensation, not just the smell, but the emotions, the feelings. Don't we really? What we really want is an immersive experience. So augmented reality is not even really kind of. That's one way to look at it. Where I'm looking at life and there's more data in my field of vision. But I think I'd be more interested in a camera that could record the full sensorium. Wouldn't that be
interesting? So the brain activity.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be interesting? And that might not be a device at all. Who knows what that is? It might be nano paint.
Nano paint.
But it all depends what you want to do with this. You know, we're talking about the recording device. What do we want to do with the thing once we've recorded it? You know, if you're... Right. There will be devices that will get better and better at capturing reality in more and more detail. That's happening now, you know, higher and higher resolutions. 3D means by which you can refocus the image, you know, with the Lytro camera. Looking forward, I thought it was interesting. I watched Blade Runner again recently, and don't see the camera that took that photo, but the famous scene is the scanner and the analysis of the flat photo that allows you to look around the scene. I'd like to see the camera that took that picture. You know, that's the kind of interesting tech there. But it'll kind of diverge into different devices for different things. And I honestly don't think there's anything wrong. And I mean, I love looking way forward, but I don't think there's anything wrong in looking at photography or imaging as a hobby and saying, you know, I do want to create this certain effect. And my goal is to create a two-dimensional picture that I'm going to stick on a wall. And I think there will still be room for that in the same way that there's still room for people who go and enjoy conventional concerts in person or classical music or sculptures. Yeah. You know, we still enjoy and create art using techniques that were developed thousands of years ago, and they're still as relevant today as they were then, or the other way around. You know what I mean?
Well, maybe what happens is artists in the future, you know how right now you have an iPad or an iPhone and you might buy an app for 99 cents or $4.99 or whatever, and maybe it's a beautiful little thing, and maybe it's short-lived and you don't really enjoy it for more than a few days, but it's kind of fun. Maybe it's a game. Maybe it's artistic. Maybe it's useful or maybe it's not, but you spend money for the experience. Well, maybe artists are able to do this thing that Leo is hinting at and use some sort of sensorium gathering device to create a unique living experience. And then you record that into something discrete, and yes, then other people can engage in that experience.
The summary would almost be that we can assume that technology will bring us that, and that what really the job of humans is once again, to curate, to make art out of this. So at some point, artists will have an unlimited palette. When you first took, you know, photographs, you had a very limited scope of what you could photograph, and it's gotten better and better and better. We can assume it's going to get better and better and better. And now it's up to humans. I think it's always going to be humans. I don't think it's algorithmic. It's up to humans to create art out of that. I love
that. There was a movie, I think it was called Strange Days. I can't remember, where you would record, you'd have this sensorium thing that would record your senses of being there. And then people could buy them from you. And there was an underground market in the snuff versions of this. So these guys would go out and they'd like murder somebody. And then
What's it feel like to die?
Yeah, exactly. And then they would sell these things and you'd have this illicit experience that would be very, very intense, high adrenaline, you know, way beyond the pale of what's outside your comfort zone. And that's just kind of the Hollywood version of this sensorium. But I think you're right. I think photography would be included or some aspects of it would be included in that kind of recording the as many senses as possible. But, you know, hey, there's other guys on this hangout that we haven't heard from. Can we hear from someone else? I feel like we're monopolizing the conversation here.
Sure. This is here our bearded friend in the second square. This is Dave Effer, our producer. He happens to be a big Demon fan.
I am.
Cool.
It was. I don't read that often, but I got recommended a Demon by two people, Trey and another friend of mine. So I started reading it, and my friend loaned me the book, and he needed it back, and I just started reading it a couple days before I gave it back, and then so I immediately got the Kindle version, and I plowed through that thing in no time. Then I got Freedom and plowed through that.
Oh, cool, and, man.
Since then, I haven't read much, but I really enjoyed
those two books. That's
it. I'm done. I've read everything I need to read. That, and then I'll read Kill Decision. And I'll be...
Yeah, that's great.
Hey, Daniel, who's going to get this stuff first? You've just finished this other book, which sounds very military-centric. But this whole new generation of awesome stuff, is it going to be the masses or the military that gets it first?
Well, see, I think given our military budget, it's going to be the military that's going to spend the money and try a million different things, most of which are going to fail, but they're going to be able to afford to do that and to really throw significant money at it. But I write a lot and I'm heading more towards writing about military stuff only because, of course, conflict is going to drive thrillers. So I think I don't want to say the cinematic aspect of it, but it certainly, you know, raises the stakes and all that other stuff. But that being said, I do think that the military is going to be using a lot of this. And if it doesn't have utility to accomplish whatever mission or purpose they find for it, they will throw it away, at which point it will then fall down, trickle down to all of us. And somebody might come up with a really cool solution.
That's how we got LSD, right?
No. Yeah, and Tang.
Just joking.
And Tang. Yeah, but, you know, actually, I have a slightly contrary view, and that is if you follow the Chris Andersons, the do-it-yourself autonomous vehicles, there's another element in which the kind of amateurs who are unconstrained by big budgets and other kinds of goals are actually, I think, leading the way in terms of the ubiquity of these. So the military is not really after ubiquitous drones. They want, you know, really big, powerful, reliable, controllable types of drones. But the amateurs are going to make a gazillion fast, cheap, and quick drones that I think is going to move us in a different direction. And so I'm not so sure this is going to come from the military. Daniel, what do you think about it? I mean, you're sure you're following this more than I am.
I look at things like Incutel, for instance. You're right. It might not spawn from the military, but certainly they monitor all sorts of things going on here, just to self-preservation. And the investment arm of the CIA, for instance, they might look at a promising DIY technology and then throw some money at it to try to give it a jump start. But then again, there's also not just the United States. I do look at swarming drones as a great equalizer. We have tremendously expensive and complex jet fighters, and I think a swarm of very cheap drones could do a real number on them. I mean, we have this great industrial base to produce these complex pieces of machinery, and then aircraft carriers to contain them and to project power. And I really look in the near future as these ubiquitous DIY drones messing with that. And as that geopolitical balance gets messed up, I think there's going to be a lot of chaos for a while as people try to figure out how that technology is going to settle. And I don't think it is, Kevin, exactly like you said, the DIY aspect, because these cheap electronic components, you know, cheap hard drive space, processing power, memory, bandwidth, all of these things are going to be combined in hundreds of millions of ways. And somebody's going to come upon one that is really useful for a time. And then you can just bang them out, you know, 100,000 at a time, not like an F-135 jet fighter, you know?
Right. Yeah.
That's not wearable cameras, but...
Cool. No, it's very interesting. That is, you know, drones are a very hardware-centric thing, whereas with AR glasses and cameras, that is kind of much more of a bottom-up type thing where you mostly need software and some basic tools. And I think it's possible that
Apple and Google will outpace the military at producing a lot of the most awesome tech that we use on a daily basis in the future.
They might. They might indeed. Then I wonder how they would deal with that, how their procurement is going to change. Because certainly they're international companies. You know, how do they balance their national versus international relationships? I wonder about that.
Well, they already have drones at Foxconn building this stuff, so.
Sadly.
Yeah. No, actually, I'm looking at robots now for Wired, and the largest purchaser of industrial robots in the world is China.
Hmm. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
China is... So offshoring is sort of really just the first step in automation and in robotization. First it goes offshore, and then it's roboticized. And so these robots right now are kind of just basically smartish arms, but a lot of the technology of perception, which is, you know, we have photography right now, and this is another discussion about photography. Right now, cameras are sort of kind of dumb. They see things, but they don't perceive them. But what if you had really smart, perceptible cameras? They could actually understand what they were seeing. And so you're kind of like, it's like, it really has a real brain, and it's processing it. And so their camera is not just kind of blankly, passively looking, but it's actually recognizing things. And so maybe you point it to something and it's kind of pulling you in a different direction, or it's doing things like it had, like there was a agent inside. And I think that's what we're adding to these robots is a sense of perception. So they're aware of where they are. They know if there's someone nearby. They can recognize if they made a mistake, all this kind of stuff. And but that may also happen with cameras. So if you saw cameras having, again, some autonomy, autonomous cameras, you know, yeah, we can understand like 1,000 industrial applications, but what about the artistic application of having autonomous cameras?
See, I know what would happen to me is I'd go to take a photo and it would say, no, that's a bad photo. And so I'd never be able to take a picture. It's not going to work, Dan.
See, I'm concerned about all of this, that we're all talking about where the cameras, well, where's the actual hobby going? We're talking about the curation of images, and we're talking about devices that can, you know, give us a massive amount of information. But what about the actual recording of it, the joy of taking a picture or of pursuing your interest? We don't seem to have talked about that. Well, I don't really think so. I kind of worry about hobbies in the future that they never seem to be discussed. You know, there's the consumption of media, but what about the production of media? What are we going to be using to create these things in the future? And I was kind of wondering if, you know, Trey, say if you're in the holodeck in 400 years' time, would you go in and instead of saying, I want some elaborate SpaceX, instead I'd like, you know, a Nikon D3X in Iceland at the Equinox or something. Would you actually go have some nostalgia for the actual visceral process of creating and capturing art?
Well, that is what all there is a strain of computer scientists that feel like we're all inside of an ancestor simulation right now, because once we all, you know, sublimate into the digital ether, it becomes a bit dull. So the only way we can find an interesting life is to inject ourselves into the life of an ancestor. So maybe that's what we're doing right now.
Sounds Mormonish. I don't know how. Mormon technology.
No, but Gordon, seriously, I wouldn't worry about hobbies and art in the future, because I think creative people will always end up getting bored and just find ways to remix things around them into something that's interesting. You know, when I'm 40 now, when I was, whatever, 20 and doing computer science in college, I didn't know that in 20 years I would be taking digital photos and sitting in Photoshop and using various tools and moving pixels around. And I mean, it's ridiculous to even think about that. So in 20 years, who knows what we'll be doing, but it's going to be awesome.
Well, how was that migration from a physical emulsion film to digital for you? Was that very traumatic? I have a photographer friend who just swore he would never go digital. And of course he did eventually.
No, in fact, it wasn't traumatic at all because I never did film.
I think I just dated myself actually, there.
It's actually kind of interesting. I know a lot of people like me that just jumped right to film. And there's another interesting example outside of photography. I don't know if you know, there's a famous composer named Hans Zimmer. And he did, you know, he does the music for Pirates of the Caribbean and Batman and Inception and all these great Hollywood hits. And he jumped right into digital. And if it wasn't for the computer, he couldn't compose the music the way he wanted to compose. So there's a whole host of creative people. Not that I'm putting myself in his magisterium, right? But there's all kinds of people now that have jumped right to digital. Just like my son, who's 11 now, he'll jump right into something. Like right now, he pretty much spends all of his free time in Minecraft. And I encourage it because this is a virtual world in which he is picking up blocks and he's reconstituting them all in different ways. And none of it really exists, but he's just playing and coming up with crazy inventions with his friends. And they're not even playing the game the right way, but there is no right way when you're just taking virtual things and reconstituting them into something else for a playful purpose. So who knows what's going to happen in 10 years.
Yeah.
Less stinky anyway, not processing. I don't know if any of you actually had your own chemical dart room, but I don't miss the stink anyway.
Yeah, I made the migration and I good riddance to film. It was immediate.
Okay.
Immediate. It was like, oh my gosh, this is so much better. This could do anything that film can do. You can just fake film with it. I can make a long list of all the advantages to digital. Lighter cameras. I would have killed to have kind of a camera that I have now instead of carrying around, you know, two bodies because two ISOs, you know, two bodies, yeah. Five lenses, 500 rolls of film.
That's right.
Amazing.
And you can't look at them until they get developed.
And you can't see them. Yeah, oh my gosh. It's just terrible, really. I mean, it's like, you know, you can imagine those guys in the out west carrying the great big view cameras and the wet plates. Mm-hmm. It's like, who would want that? It's not good. It's not really. There's no nostalgia for me. And I think we'll probably look at, you know, what we have right now and in 50 years, and people would say, I can't believe that they had those little digital cameras. That's right.
You weigh two ounces.
Yeah, they had moved little buttons around. Oh my gosh.
Well, it's been about an hour, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up now. And I wanted to thank you guys. But first, let me plug another show on Leo's massive Twit network, Twit Photo, which comes up tomorrow. And Leo and Catherine are going to have on a wedding photographer. His name is Jerry Gionis.
Gionis. Thank you.
Gionis. What does Twit stand for? I don't know Twit.
This Week in Tech.
Ah.
It was the first show that we did, Kevin, and then we decided to name the network after our best-known show. And I like it because it mocks us.
Oh, I get it now. Okay. Well, thank you for having me.
Yes. Well, thank you, everybody. Thank you for taking it in so many wonderful random directions. I'm interested in everything. I could talk about this stuff for the next 10 hours, but I think often what is beautiful and interesting is also ephemeral. So with that, we should probably bring
and
it
like,
to...
And like all art, you need to know when to stop.
And this again is with the curation.
Right.
Yeah. Pleasure, right, well, guys. Thanks, everybody. We can just wave goodbye and we'll just cut the broadcast.
I can't wait to get your book, Daniel. Can't wait.
Cool. I will send you one's book. Take care.
Great.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Daniel.
Goodbye.
Thanks.